Today's story is five courageous women. On a scale of 1 to 10, how courageous are you? Some of us are in the 1 to 5 category. I admit it, I don't want to fight. I'd rather run and hide. I don't want to face danger. I'd rather pull the covers over my head. Our story today gives us a broader picture of what courage looks like. It might not involve slaying dragons. Sometimes it means doing the right thing. Sometimes it means doing the hard thing. Our story begins in Exodus chapter 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah; Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin; Dan and Naphtali; Gad and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died. But the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so that the land was filled with them. Then a new king, who did not know about Joseph, came to power in Egypt. "Look," he said to his people, "the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor and brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, "When you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live." The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" The midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive." So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people: "Every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live." Now, a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. And the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water." This is a familiar story to some, but we need to be careful that we don't get our facts from Disney's Prince of Egypt. The first few verses set up the drama that is about to take place. Verse 1. Most English translations begin with, "These are the names of the sons of Israel." In Hebrew, the first word is vav, meaning and. The book begins with and. This story is a continuation of the story of Genesis, a continuation of God's promises to Abraham and the nation of Israel. In verses 2 through 4, the first six names are the six sons of Leah. Then Benjamin is the son of Rachel. Dan and Naphtali are the sons of Bilhah, who is Rachel's maid, and Gad and Asher are the sons of Zilpah, who is Leah's maid. Verse 5. The number 70 is a reference point. They began with 70 people, and now we see how much they have multiplied in the 300-plus years they've been in Egypt. Verses 6 and 7 give us a layered description. The Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous so that the land was filled with them. Now, where have we heard these words before? Fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. They are echoes from Genesis. God told Adam and Eve, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Same three verbs. God told Abraham in Genesis 15, your descendants will be like the stars in the sky. The author is showing us how God is carrying out his plan for Israel by bringing them to Egypt, beginning with Joseph. Verse 8, now there's a turn in political events. There's a new sheriff in town, a new king who does not know about Joseph. Well, why does he not know about Joseph? Because more than 300 years have passed. I guess he didn't keep up with his history lessons. What is ironic is that the king of Egypt, the new Pharaoh, is the only one in the story who lacks courage. He's paranoid about the increasing Hebrew population. He fears that if war breaks out, the large number of Israelites will join the enemy and fight against him. He expresses his fear to his people and stirs up their animosity. They begin to dread the Israelites. So Pharaoh comes up with a plan. They put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They make their lives bitter with hard labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. Verses 13 and 14, we find two times the word ruthlessly. The Egyptians worked them and used them ruthlessly. It means without pity or compassion, merciless. The king thinks that his plan to oppress them and enslave them will cause them to stop having babies. Wrong. His plan backfires and they multiply even more. Now we meet the two Hebrew midwives, Shiphrah and Puah. The king summons them with his new plan. When you help the Hebrew women in childbirth, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live. Well, why kill the boys? Because boys are a military threat. Now, this story is full of irony. Pharaoh tells the midwives to kill only boys, assuming the girls are no threat. Pharaoh underestimates the potential in girls who have other ways to fight. The ones who thwart Pharaoh's plan are two little girls who grow up to be courageous midwives. The Bible Dictionary gives us the job description for midwives. Be there for the delivery, cut the umbilical cord, wash the baby with water, rub with salt, and then wrap up the baby. Now we see courage on display. The two midwives have no intention of obeying the king. They know there will be consequences. He knows who they are and where they live. It's a risk. We're told twice the reason for their courage. They fear God. Verse 17, the midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Their fear of God comes from their faith in God. But what do they really know about God? Think about the time in which they are living. Exodus chapter 1. God has not yet revealed himself as Yahweh. They only know him as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They don't have the law or the Ten Commandments yet. They don't even have thou shalt not kill. All they have are the stories from Genesis passed down orally. But let's not forget, faith comes by hearing. They know the promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They know that Israel is God's chosen people and that God has an eternal plan that includes them. When Pharaoh realizes that they are defying his order, he calls them back in. They explain that Hebrew women are so vigorous they give birth before the midwives arrive. Now, can we admit here that we are a little disappointed with their answer? We wanted a bold declaration of defiance, something similar to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in Daniel 3. Our God is able to deliver us, and even if he does not, we will not obey you, O king. Well, that's not anything like their answer. In fact, they lie. Verse 17 told us they let the boys live. It's a less than perfect answer. But let's not judge them too quickly. They're facing a moral dilemma more complicated than we initially think. When they are summoned back to the king, they know why. And they probably have a day or more to think about their response because there's some sort of travel involved. Like, they don't live in the palace. There's no trains. There's no Uber. They know why the king has summoned them, and they have time to think about what to say as they travel. What are their options? Well, if the midwives tell the truth, we have no intention of obeying you, then most likely they will lose their lives. And Pharaoh might appoint Egyptian midwives over the Hebrew women who will kill the boys. So there's much more at stake than just their lives. An entire nation is at stake. What would you do? How would you answer the great and mighty Pharaoh? Somehow, their simple answer satisfies the king. Maybe he isn't the sharpest pencil in the drawer. We know he wasn't good at history, and now we see he's not very good at logic. The midwives' actions demonstrate that they fear God more than they fear a human king. And God honors their courage with kindness and a reward and no mention of a reprimand. Now, I always pictured these two midwives as two old ladies. Not so. They are of childbearing age, and God now gives them children of their own. Verse 22. We see that Pharaoh has no regard for the sanctity of human life. He has three plans to reduce the population of the Hebrews, and as each plan fails, he goes on to the next plan. The first plan was hard labor. Well, that didn't work. The second plan was for the midwives to kill all the boys, and that doesn't work. Plan number three. Pharaoh now gives the responsibility to those in whom it serves their best interest. Egyptians must now take it upon themselves to control the population by drowning Hebrew baby boys in the Nile. What about the girls? Well, the girls will most likely become slave wives. This was very common in the ancient Near East, and this will increase the Egyptian population. So the plan to kill the boys but save the girls helps Egypt in two ways. It decreases the population of Israel and increases the population of Egypt. As the chapter closes, we don't hear any more about our courageous midwives. But we see in the next chapter three more courageous women. Chapter 2, verse 1. Now a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman. Now why do they mention that they are Levites? They don't yet know the unique role of Levites. But they do know that Levi belongs to the 12 tribes of Israel. The label Levite connects them to God's chosen people and God's story. Now we meet an unnamed woman who marries, becomes pregnant, and gives birth. We're told later in Exodus chapter 6 that her name is Jochebed. Now in Hebrew, it's Yocheved, but we just call her Jochebed. Put yourself in her shoes for a minute, and the shoes of every other Hebrew woman of childbearing years. You're pregnant for 9 months. You know it, and everyone else around you knows it. But there are no gender reveal parties. You have a 50-50 chance of having a boy. You give birth, and now everyone's afraid to ask, boy or girl? And half the women are afraid to answer. Verse 2, when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. Well, doesn't everyone think their baby's a fine child? That's not what she's saying. In Hebrew, the word fine is tov, which means good. Jochebed is repeating what God said at creation in Genesis. After each day of creation, God saw that it was good. Same words in Exodus, when she saw that he was good. Jochebed is building up her courage with the truth she knows from Genesis. Her baby is a good creation, and she will not be intimidated by Pharaoh. In the New Testament, Hebrews 11, by faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw he was no ordinary child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. Courage. But at some point, practicality takes over. You can't hide a person forever. Verse 3. Our English translation reads, she got a papyrus basket for him. But in Hebrew, it says, she got a papyrus ark for him. Same word as Noah's ark in Genesis 6. Jochebed knows the story of the ark. God saved humanity through the ark. Noah's ark represented a safe place of preservation that rested on top of the water. Jochebed coats it with tar and pitch, the same two substances used in Noah's ark, making it waterproof. She operates from the only knowledge she has, stories from Genesis. Just as Noah builds an ark to save his family, this mother builds an ark to save hers. Then, in an act of courage that we can hardly get our heads around, she places her baby in the ark and puts him in the Nile. Where does her courage come from? Hope. She puts her hope in God and puts her son in the Nile. Now, a new character enters the story. The baby has an older sister. She's not named here, but we find out later in Exodus that her name is Miriam. How old is she, we wonder? Well, the clue comes in verse 8. The girl went and got the baby's mother. Girl is the Hebrew word alma, meaning virgin, young woman of marriageable age. This word is never used of a child. So if you're picturing a 6-year-old child, that's the wrong picture. She's somewhere between 12 and 15. She waits from a distance and watches to see what will happen to her baby brother. You know she loves that baby. She's been helping care for him and hide him for 3 months. Next, we meet the princess, Pharaoh's daughter, who goes down to the Nile to bathe. She sees the basket and sends her slave girl to get it. She opens the basket and sees the baby. He's crying. "This is a Hebrew baby," she said. "Well, how does she know that?" "Because he's circumcised." She peeked. Egyptians don't circumcise infants. Pharaoh's daughter now has her own dilemma. What to do with this baby? She knows her father's edict. She knows her people's attitude. They dread the Israelites. She has three options. She can drown the baby right there, obeying her father's command. Or she can tell her slave girl to do the dirty work. The second option is leave him there, putting his fate in someone else's hands. And the third option is help him. But why would she even consider helping him? Verse 6 says, she feels sorry for him. Sorry that it's not his fault. Sorry that he has no future, no chance of survival in this brutal environment. What kind of courage does it take to go against a powerful father, a ruthless ruler, and the will of your own country? Who has that kind of courage? Where does it come from? Well, Proverbs tells us, the king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wishes. If this is true of the king, why not the king's daughter? Pharaoh's daughter has compassion on the baby, the opposite of the ruthless treatment her people have shown toward Israel. Now, the baby sister speaks up at the right time. She seizes the moment right now to offer a solution and assistance. Miriam is courageous because there's a risk. What if Pharaoh's daughter, realizing that she's being watched, feels pressure to obey her father? How horrifying to see her brother drowned before her eyes. It's a risk, but one that she must take. Why? Love, one of the two most powerful emotions, love and fear. There's a practical matter here that must be solved. The baby needs milk. It was not uncommon to hire a wet nurse, as they were called, someone that you pay to feed your baby if for some reason you can't. They didn't have formula back then. Pharaoh's daughter responds to the suggestion as if it's the natural and logical thing to do. Yes, go. The sister goes and gets the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter's words declare her intention. Verse 9, take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you. Now, it's one thing to feel sorry for a crying baby born on the wrong side of politics. It's another thing to adopt him as your own son and take on a responsibility that is not yours. How likely is her kind deed to be exposed and punished? She has attendants with her who are now witnesses. It's a risk. Her decision to make the child her own is courageous. The mother takes the baby and nurses him so she gets her baby back. But his future is still uncertain. Scholars tell us that women at that time nursed their babies until around age 3. Will the princess change her mind in those 3 years? Will God provide another way out, or will she have to give him up a second time? We know the conclusion of the story. When the child grew older, his mother took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. Jochebed surrendered her child to his new mother. She let go of what she thought was hers. Pharaoh's daughter gives him a new name and a new identity. He is now Moses with all the privileges of a son of royalty. Let's draw some conclusions about our five courageous women and see what parallels there are for us. Where did their courage come from? Faith, hope, love, and compassion. Did you notice that the word courage is nowhere found in our passage? Neither is faith, hope, or love. C.S. Lewis writes, "Courage is not simply one of the virtues, but the form of every virtue at the testing point." Okay, let me read that again. Courage is not simply one of the virtues, but the form of every virtue at the testing point. This is absolutely what we see in this story. Our two midwives, Shifra and Pua. By the way, they're the only ones given names in our passage. It was their faith in the God of Israel that gave them courage to stand up to Pharaoh. But how much did they really know about God? 50 chapters of Genesis that weren't even written down yet. That's all they knew. But they held to the convictions they had and became courageous when their faith was tested. Where is God asking you to be courageous? Is there someone you need to stand up to? Have you been asked at work or somewhere else to go against your Christian convictions? You've heard the saying, courage isn't just standing up to your enemies. Sometimes it's standing up to your friends. Let your faith in God give you the courage to say no and the courage to let the consequences fall wherever God wills. Jochebed. No one would ever choose her part in God's redemption story. She didn't choose it. She faced two excruciating decisions and then spent a lifetime living with the choices she made. Where did her courage come from? It was hope that God would rescue her child. She put her hope in God and put her son in the Nile. Her hope was then severely tested. What kind of courage does it take to give your baby to be raised by the enemy? It's unthinkable. Does God sometimes ask us to do the unthinkable? Sometimes. Jochebed's story quickly shuts down the myth that God won't give you more than you can handle. Of course he will. Otherwise, we don't need him. Jochebed put her son's future in God's hands. She let go of what she thought was hers. She never knew the end of her son's story, but we know it. God rescued her son and then used her son to rescue an entire nation. What unthinkable situation has God dropped on you? Is there something in your life that God is asking you to let go of? Is there someone that you love that you need to put in a basket and release to God? Are you afraid to let go because you cannot see the future? Put your hope in God and put your loved one in the basket. Our fourth courageous woman is Miriam. Understanding her courage is not complicated. It began as love for a baby brother, and then that love was tested. She was young and inexperienced and had no script to follow. God put her in the right place at the right time. And when her heart started beating quickly, she spoke up. God used her as a mediator between her mother and Pharaoh's daughter. It would be easy to overlook her part in the story, but without her involvement, the story would not have turned out the way it did. By her courageous action, God gave her a part in his redemption story. Don't discount your part in God's story, though it may seem insignificant. Is God asking you to be a mediator in a prickly situation? Keep watching and waiting for God to put you in the right place at the right time. And when your heart starts racing, you know it's go time. Take a risk, speak up, and God will use you. Pharaoh's daughter, her courage came from compassion, but human compassion can only take you so far. This was God-given compassion that overruled loyalty to her father and her country. This is another example in Scripture of how God uses non-believers for his purposes. God took a princess, put compassion in her heart, and gave her the courage to take on a responsibility that was not hers. Ironically, she had a part in saving the nation her father tried to distort. Don't underestimate how God uses those outside the faith. Were you raised in an unbelieving home? I was. Have you ever made excuses for yourself because of your upbringing? I have. Acknowledge that God is sovereign in where you were raised and by whom. God's purposes are much bigger than you can see, and he will use your background for the assignments he gives you. Courage looks different for each person. Two midwives stood up to a powerful bully. Miriam spoke up when the time was right. Jochebed let go of what she thought was hers. Pharaoh's daughter took on a responsibility that wasn't hers. Each of these women demonstrated great courage, and by their courageous action, God gave them a part in his redemption story. Courage looks different at different seasons. Some of you in this room are facing huge challenges in your life right now that will require great courage. Some of you are not. I'm thankful that God doesn't ask us to slay dragons every single day. I want to close with a quote about quiet courage, Marianne Rodmacher. Courage doesn't always roar. Sometimes courage is the little voice at the end of the day that says, "I'll try again tomorrow."